The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
KMED, here's Bill Myers.
11 minutes after 6, it is Pebble in Your Shoe Tuesday, a great time to check in and share your concerns, things that have bugged you this morning. Traditionally, that's what it is, but I'm actually going to start the show off this morning with a story that the Daily Courier was reporting the other day, which just cheers my heart, because you read about, okay, here's the latest homelessness statistic, here's the the latest drug addiction death or something like that. Well, they ended up having the community rallying around our foster kids. A nonprofit group gives out Christmas presents and birthday cards and school supplies to Josephine County youth in foster care. But then what happened is that the weekend after Thanksgiving, some dirt bags broke into a warehouse used by the group to store presents and supplies. And the burglars, according to Vicki Aldous of the Daily Courier, targeting adult-sized bikes and electronics intended for the teenagers. And what ended up happening then is that the community just rallied around the group. And they ended up getting so many presents, gift cards, and financial donations that our foster kids will be able to help even more children than the group originally tried to do before the theft. So not that we would advocate for stealing, but the community really came out for the kids, and that is just a great, great story. And just wanted to salute that. It's just great to see the people like that pull together. It really is. And you know, you hear those kind of stories all the time, which the Thanksgiving feast gets stolen and then everybody ends up making up for it. That's kind of the way we are here in Southern Oregon. Meanwhile, though, the attempts to tamp down the disorder continuing, the Ashland City Council has approved another expulsion area for the south side of town. And these expulsion areas are for, the homeless and people, drug addicts and people that find themselves in trouble at some point. And then the way I understand it, you know, you'll be more or less told you can't go there. It's sad that we have to be that way, but that is the reality of where we find ourselves in today's situation. It's also interesting that you're going to hear about, Bill London in the KMED News Center is going to be reporting a little bit later about how there's a challenge in our economy in Oregon. Oregon, number 47, number 48, if I recall correctly, on the income, on the median family income. And it's a really, it's something that you should be really taking and running through your head, because so much of what is happening here in Oregon are actually self-inflicted gunshot wounds. I'm looking here on OPB. Oregon's Project Turnkey sheltered thousands as state tries to build more homes. State tries to build more homes, and they profile this one guy, just before a tour of an Astoria homeless shelter late last month, Governor Tina Kotek met with a single father living there with his children. He'd been paying rent for nearly 5 years in nearby Seaside. His landlord terminated the lease, and father and the kids were homeless. Remote coastal region of Oregon, state's highest per capita rate of homelessness. Until 2023, it had no permanent shelters, even though more than 1 in 50 Clatsop County residents were homeless that year. 1 in 50, that's a huge percentage when it comes right down to it. And this particular father, among thousands of people statewide, being housed through Project Turnkey. Now, this is an Oregon program, takes $125 million of taxpayer money and turned it into 1,400 new shelter beds, mostly by buying and converting existing hotels and other vacant shelters. Now, remember, we've had that happen here with some of our hotels here in Southern Oregon. The interesting part about the OPB article is not that, hey, they've built these and then people came and that people are hurting, but that more than half of the people, even after they get out of the shelters, end up remaining homeless. Now, this particular father that was profiled in the OPB story, it was not about, a drug-addicted type of situation. This was just someone finding themselves on hard times. And Bill is going to be reporting on the economic realities of what's happening, in which wages in Oregon are low. Now, we've known that. Wages have always been low in Oregon. When I moved here in 1991, I was surprised at how low some of the salaries were done. And that was even then. But I honestly think that we've probably been doing more to generate self-inflicted gunshot wounds over the years, even since the time I moved here to the Valley, than we did even back then. And a lot of it, to me, tends to come through, this is my opinion, I don't know if you have an opinion on this, but my take on it has always been that Oregon gets in the way of someone making a buck or two. And if you're making a buck or two, there's obviously something wrong with you, because if you're making a buck or two, you're probably destroying the planet. And so, yeah, I'm laying a lot of this at the climate change rackets, the environmental rackets, the NGOs that have tended to control so much of Oregon's economy. Doesn't matter if as an example, the spotted owl was just a lie, and now we're going out trying to shoot the barred owls in order to bring balance, you know, to this. That you know, anytime a chainsaw ends up starting off in a forest here, which is something that we are very wealthy in, we are still wealthy in wood, you can't catch a break. And so you end up having these mills closing around here since the 1980s and 1990s. Look at Josephine County, rough and ready. Every time I drive out to the coast and I'm going through Josephine County, I'm still looking at that old, you know, that old mill, and I'm remembering all the people who used to work at these kind of facilities. That you didn't have to have a college degree necessarily to get in there, but it was honest work. And people built families, and people built dreams, and people actually built stuff. They built stuff. They processed wood. They brought it out. Now, we still have some mills around here, but nothing nearly to what it used to be. That was a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Now what we do is that this wealth in the forest is allowed to just grow and grow and grow, and then we burn it in the summer. And that seems to be how we make money now. We hope that United States of America will continue to write hot checks and grant stream funding into the state of Oregon. And then we'll have everybody going to work for Loma Kotze. we'll all work for the Loma Kotze project because, well, we can't actually, harvest our public lands and harvest our wealth. We can't do that. We can't do that. It is much more morally superior to then burn this. Burn it all or hand remove it at taxpayer expense rather than actually generating some economic impact. But that seems to be really the Oregon way. And people will, look at one another and it's like, no, we don't want to take care of the homeless situation because now we have a lot of people who are living on the grant stream fundings like the Stabbin' Wagon type organizations that, if we got rid of the homeless, gosh, what would we do? We there wouldn't be any need. We'd have to actually find something productive. So I ultimately think the root of where we find ourselves with affordability and with low wages is that we have such a mindset here in Oregon, and it is political. It is mostly political from the left that if somebody is making a buck somewhere, that's a bad thing, and then everything has to be sustainable. You'll hear that sustainability kind of talk all the time. But the one thing that they never talk about, they being the political left here in the state, they never talk about sustainability as far as finance, because nothing happens until something gets sold and money is exchanged and there's an ability to be able to afford to do it. You're not going to hire people at good wages unless you're able to sell for a good profit. And Oregon doesn't seem to really be focused on that good profit side of things. And yet I love our state. This is home to me. So I'm not just, bashing this system to make you depressed about that, but to help people think more about what actually is the root cause. We have a very small percentage of our land actually developed. And yet, what do we do to make sure that that housing is expensive and rare and is very difficult to get? Well, we end up having state land use planning, and we totally restrict where you're able to build, even though we're just drowning in space. We're just absolutely drowning in space in this state. But you wouldn't know about it, by the way. You know, you're only supposed to build a house inside the urban growth boundary because, well, we don't want to have sprawl. And I will remind you that one person's sprawl is another person's affordable house. And the people who have their house, I think, are trying to make sure that nobody else ever gets theirs. And that's the way they like it. And so they want to keep them all stack and pack. And now I imagine pretty soon nice regular single-family homes are going to be knocked down and so we can put up more habit trails. We'll be sustainable, right? All right, so I know I'm just kind of meandering a bit about this, but, you know, when I hear about the low wages and then the low housing and the unaffordability, and it's like there seems to be so little willingness to connect it to actual state policy. Hey, Tom, how are you doing this morning? Welcome. Good to have you on.
Thank you, Bill. Yeah, pebble in the shoe. You're right on target again. Pebble, I'll call it today, is all the fees for licenses. I had a friend that I know, she's just well, person I know, to get a hairdresser license or be able to cut people's hair, thousands and thousands of dollars in fees and
then you'd have to ask yourself what, right? Why?
Well, it's the feed the bureaucracy, and I know in my own thing. You talked about profit and how it's looked down upon. Well, when I my license was held for ransom because you got to take something called cultural competence.
Yeah, you got to take the DEI test. You got to take the DEI test. See, that's something else, though. It's friction in the gears. It doesn't actually produce anything, right?
Well, it's worse than that. It's not just non-production. It's counterproduction. So there I am, you know, and taking this course in order to maintain my license. And there's a Black Panther there looking, scowling at us and saying, you know, profit is evil. And it's the cause of why we're in such terrible.
Yeah, place. Yeah. And those are the people running the state. And you see, like I say, these are choices.
Exactly.
These are choices that have been made. Great call. Thank you. And this is just one guy. This is just one guy getting his medical license, you know, just one guy getting his practitioner's license, chiropractic license, and he has to go through the just amazing story. Thanks for sharing that, Tom. It is 6:23 at KMED.
When it's time for a new roof, think beyond shingles. Metal roofing from Pressure Point Roofing offers unmatched durability, longevity, and protection.
772 sold. That's 541-772-7653. Jared Hokanson of Hokanson Realty.
Good morning. This is News Talk 106.3 KMED, and you're waking up with the Bill Myers Show.
It's 6:25.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
You know, I was talking about how so much of the news is bad, and it's great to be able to share some holiday cheer in this time. So now we're going to be lurching back to that. Joining me right now is Mickey Thomas of Starship, Jefferson Starship. Legendary vocalist, power vocalist. How you doing this morning, Mickey? Welcome.
Well, I'm doing great. How are you, Bill?
Doing great. Boy, did you ever think that small-town boy, I guess, was ever going to make it this big over the years between Elvin Bishop and Starship? And now you've had, I guess you've been keeping the Starship brand alive for several years, haven't you, ever since that?
Yeah, trying to. You know, we've been out there on the road constantly for the last almost 50 years now. So, and keeping the Starship brand alive and singing Fooled Around and Fell in Love every night. And, man, staying busy.
Yeah. Do you ever get to that point where I can't sing Fooled Around and Fell in Love one more time? I just can't do it tonight. I know it's your baby. It really is. I mean, I get that, but do you ever have that? I've always wondered about someone that has such a signature song like that. Or how do you view that, huh?
No, I never get tired of singing that one, especially that one.
Really?
Because, you know, it was the first big hit ever that I ever had, the first time I heard my voice on the radio, and it was a song that opened up so many doors for me, and I especially enjoy singing it, too, because in the context of the Starship show, it's a real nice change of pace. Like, you know, about two-thirds of the way through the show, I usually do Fooled Around, and it's kind of a spot where I can step back and take a breath and kind of get back to my roots. And I definitely enjoy singing fooling around every single night. You know, I'm one of those artists that I'm not one of those guys that like gets sick of, you know, singing the hits over and over and over, because I know that's what people want to hear. That's what people, you know, pay to come in here. And if I go and see an artist that I love, you know, I want them to play the songs that I want to hear as well. So it doesn't bother me at all.
Yeah. So as far as you're concerned, it's like writing a check to yourself, right? In some ways.
Yeah,
you know, well, I'm glad you feel. I'm glad you feel that way too, because I remember one time I saw Willie Nelson. I think it was when the IRS was going after him, and he was performing here in Southern Oregon, and you could tell he just resented going through all his hits. That was palpable. Yeah. I'm glad you don't do this now. I don't recall Starship or anybody ever having done a Christmas album. So is this the first foray into Christmas classics, which is like what we started off with from your classic Christmas album?
Yes, this is my first Christmas album. I've wanted to do it forever. And finally got a chance to do it. You know, my manager helped me a lot, putting the whole project together. He one of his lifelong friends who produced it, a guy named Danny Frizzell, put together the musicians for me. We did it in Nashville, and it was just a great experience. So, you know, I'm so happy with the way it turned out. I love the record. It captured exactly what I wanted to hear.
And it's your voice, the pipes are sounding so good. What do you keep a portrait of your pipes up in the attic or something like that? Because it's like, I mean, you've been doing. Yeah, exactly. Now, I don't.
No.
Now, just the other day, you turned 75. I saw you just had a birthday here. I mean, you've been on the road a long time, and it's still solid as a rock, man. How do you do that?
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky, I guess. You know, I just have, like I always say, my parents just gave me some strong genes, because, you know, I can't explain it any other way, but I have been very fortunate. You know, I'm proud to say that we do all the songs in the original keys that we recorded them in. So, you know, hopefully it's going to stick with me for a few more years, because I'm certainly enjoying it. You know, you mentioned that I turned 75. I'm in Germany right now, touring with a 100-piece orchestra, a 25-piece choir. And on my birthday in Frankfurt the other night, on stage in front of the audience, sold out show, the whole orchestra and choir sang happy birthday to me.
Oh,
that
man.
That was a very touching moment for me. You know, that was one of those moments where you stop and kind of take it all in. And I think, like, how did a boy from South Georgia ever get to this point in my life, you know, and have this happening for me? It was very touching, very moving, you know. And, man, life is good.
I am so proud to have a chance to talk with you, because I've been listening to you for years. And over the weekend, I had just popped in Jane from your Starship days. And I'm just listening to the power in your vocals and the way you're able to keep that going. And you're still doing these powerful vocals. And, of course, we're hearing a little bit of a softer side, more a mellow side in the classic Christmas. But that's really great, too, because you're a wonderful balladeer. And I think a lot of people didn't know that about you. Would that be fair for a while?
Yeah, that's probably true. You know, the Christmas album gave me a chance to, you know, everything is down a little bit, you know, as far as keys and stuff and like and where I'm singing, you know, I got to kind of take it out of the stratosphere a little bit and try to create something that was a little warmer and it was easier on my voice. It was physically easier on the voice, but it was also hard to create the atmosphere that I wanted to create with these songs, with singing kind of in a lower register and a little breathier and warmer. And I had to work more on creating the right mood, the right atmosphere.
Yeah. And congratulations on a great album. This is available with all the streaming services. And what is your website, by the way, Mickey, before you take off?
Starshipcontrol.com. And, yeah, you're right. It's available everywhere. It's available on vinyl and CD. The vinyl's really cool because it's red and white, Christmas colors, so it's pretty cool.
All right. Well, I hope to hear about
what
you sing.
I say red and white. I meant red and green.
Red and green. Okay. Well, I'm still hoping to hear you singing Fool Around and Fell in Love in maybe when you're in your 80s, okay? You're up for it, aren't you?
I'm definitely up for it. I'll be doing it.
Mickey Thomas.
We're going to come to Medford and sing it.
I look forward to it. I'll be there. Mickey, thanks for joining the show this morning. Great talking with you, okay? Mickey Thomas, and he has a brand new Christmas album out, and it is a classic Christmas. But yet he still loves singing this even today. Great story. 6:32 at KMED, 99.3 KBXG. Dr. Carol Lieberman will join me after news, and we're going to delve in a little bit to the mind of the sicko that took out the United Healthcare CEO. And of course, she's America's psychiatrist, and she's pretty darn good at that stuff.
Tis the season for giving and getting. Now through the 15th, stop by any Gerson's location and make a $50 tax-deductible donation to Access. That's the giving part. Now for the getting. In return for your generous donation, you'll get 10% off just about any item in any Gerson store. While you provide...
Stay. When you're here, your family. Find out more at rvcc.com or call us at 541-772-5965.
Hi, I'm Michael with Gage of Construction, and I'm on KMED.
Proud to have Dr. Carol Lieberman back on the program. She's known as America's psychiatrist, board-certified Beverly Hills psychiatrist, written a couple of books on terrorism, too. Five-time award-winning book, Lions and Tigers and Terrorists, How to Protect Your Child in a Time of Terror. And she also hosts the Terrorist Therapist Show podcast. Latest episode is Terror, Coming to a Stadium or Concert Near You. And she delves into the plans of ISIS, Al-Qaeda, and the Taliban, and how the White House has actually been helping them. Dr. Lieberman, it is a pleasure having you back. Welcome. Good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
Yeah, it's well, you're the sanest person I know, so I guess that's a that's a good thing. Yeah. Hey, you know, before we delve into the United Healthcare CEO murder and how his suspect, his suspected murderer, was arrested yesterday, tell us a little bit about this terror coming to a stadium or concert near you. What were you going into on that? Because there hasn't been a lot of talk about domestic terrorism as of late. And, of course, things are a little sporty in the Middle East right now with what's happening in Syria. And Israel's been bombing that. And the chess pieces are moving, I guess, right now, in other words. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes. Yes, of course. You know, it's basically... the sort of an update on what I've been saying a lot for years. I've been doing my terrorist therapist podcast and warning people in various ways because of various reasons how terrorists are coming to us. Or, you know, people think that like Hamas invaded Israel October 7th, and people are thinking, you know, well, this is just it's just Israel, you know, it's just Israel that terrorists want to kill and destroy and so on. When really Israel is just the canary in the coal mine, and terrorists have planned for, you know, 1,000 years that they want to take over the whole world. It is to spread Sharia over the whole world. So, and people don't realize that or don't want to believe that, but we are on their to-do list, and there are more terrorists in more secret cells and more terrorists essentially on college campuses, you know, the pro-Hamas people, what do you think that they are? They are essentially terrorists themselves.
What gives me pause is to look at what happened in Syria over the weekend, Dr. Lieberman, and realize that the people, not that I was any fan of Assad, I'm not, you know, I wasn't, you know, he's over in Moscow now. But the people that ended up taking his place, in essence, are... an Al Qaeda offshoot, right? You know, is that have we taken someone bad and replaced it with someone worse? I don't know if you'll get into that or not, but that's one of the thoughts that went through my head. Israel figured they had to go bomb it and take care of business.
Yes, that was interesting how Israel did that rather quickly before you know, took care of it before it got worse.
Yeah, yeah, they didn't sit around and wait, did they? They didn't wait to see what was going to happen afterwards. Okay, we got Al-Qaeda that's taking over Syria here. We're going to make sure we're going to take these weapons out of commission here. Well, we're just going to drop a few big ones there. But anyway, I thought that was pretty interesting. Let's shift the gears this morning here. I did want to get your take overall on the suspected killer of UnitedHealthcare CEO Brian Thompson. And... And we all like to, you know, look, you like to look at these from a psychiatrist's point of view and what might have been driving some of this. And this this guy, you know, Luigi, was an amazingly privileged young man, went to a $37,000 a year prep school, right? So we're talking, he was living the life, wasn't he, really? And what happened? What
and
do you think?
And that was 40,000 10 years ago. So, you know, yes. What is happening? Well, actually, you know, when this first happened, when the shooting first happened, I said from the very beginning, this has to be a disgruntled patient or someone who had a loved one who was, you know, treated unfairly by their insurance, by this particular insurance, preferably.
And that's not hard to find. It really isn't hard hard to find these days.
Well, yes, which is why everyone, you know, why there are so many people rooting for this guy, you know, because so many, we can all relate to that, either for ourselves or for a loved one, you know, and how insurance didn't give them all the care that they needed.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, of course, the interesting thing is, though, that then his family has turned out to be super rich. And so you kind of wonder why. I mean, he had a grandmother and a grandfather who died and some other relative. And so there was some question about, you know, maybe they were the ones who didn't get the treatment that they needed and so on. And also it's now coming out that he has some kind of spinal surgery. But you kind of have to wonder, well, even if the insurance didn't pay, certainly their family, his family, had enough money to pay for it himself. But he also worked in his family owns an old age home. And he worked there for a little while when he was in high school, you know, volunteered there, I presume. And so perhaps also it has to do with what he saw at that time. And also in college, now even in elementary school, but certainly in college, kids are being taught that capitalism is bad and all of these, you know, everybody's just out to make money and they don't care about each other and, you know, these big corporations. And certainly Brian Thompson, who was making $10 million a year, it was a good example of that. And especially since, you know, it's come out, I'm sure you read this too,
mm-hmm.
or heard this, that United Healthcare was using AI to deny people. They weren't even looking at it as people, you know, individuals.
Yeah, they would just run it through an algorithm, the AI algorithm, and it was almost kind of the equivalent of kind of like a Roman emperor played by the part of AI, you know, thumb up, thumb down. You get treatment,
yes,
right?
Yes.
That sort of thing.
Right. And it was mostly thumb down. So you can understand why he would be angry about that. Also, he did seem like somewhat of a maverick. You know, he was a leader. Did you see the video of his giving his speech as the valedictorian of his high school?
No, I did not. I did not see that. What can you tell me about it?
That is a fascinating watch. It's online in a number of different, you know, articles. It showed him. He was 16 years old. He was, you know, had the honor of giving a graduation speech because he was the valedictorian. And he gave a pretty okay speech, but it was a speech where he talked about his class, his graduating class, and how, you know, it kind of combined both tradition, acknowledging tradition, and also there are a lot of things created a lot of things to begin. Like, for example, one of them was they added an extra recess. In the morning. So like before school, instead of just sitting around the hall waiting for school to begin, they started some kind of a recess program and other things. So he was proud of these innovations, in other words. But the thing that that kind of goes along with his wanting to be someone who would innovate take out this CEO like to do something that he would be remembered for and you know, an innovation. But the thing that caught my eye was that there were these two classmates behind him who, while he was giving his speech, they were sort of talking and smiling and talking about something else, not paying attention to him, and kind of laughing together. And it made me wonder about how, whether he was bullied in school, you know, how, whether all his classmates really liked him or were impressed by him, or whether there was some like jealousy or some, you know, some, not everybody loved him, in other words.
Mm-hmm.
And that apparently would have affected him too.
I'm talking with Dr. Carol Lieberman, MD. Dr. Carol's Couch, by the way, available on voiceamerica.com and the Terrorist Therapist podcast. And we'll put the information up so you can find out more about Dr. Carol. The part that kind of stuck out at me, though, of course, he's an Ivy League grad. And
right.
Is it possible to graduate from the Ivy League these days without having a hatred? Because he's not that, he's a young man, you know, relatively young man. Who has destroyed his life, of course, you know, from the looks of it. And can you graduate from the Ivy League now and be mentally healthy about the way the world really works? I mean, it's a serious question. I mean, you may be laughing about this, but
I know. I mean, yes, you know, of course, it's so ironic, though, because you would think of all people who were going to be who would have a healthy attitude, you know, and know a lot about the world, it would be from the Ivy League. But there are a lot of distortions, a lot of being taught that that America is bad, and you know, people who are making a lot of money, you know, it's not some of them are bad, and you know, of course, all the anti-Semitism and so on. So it's not the same as it once was. There are a lot of influences, including from teachers, that don't set them off, people who are being graduated off to create the best life that they could.
He was angry about capitalism, which is interesting, given that capitalism ended up enabling his amazing life, the ability to go to like a $40,000 a year prep school, which most of us would have only dreamed of you know, when I was growing up, you know, that kind of thing. And yet he goes after a health insurance executive as the symbol of it.
Right.
And you being within the medical, the psychiatry world, I think you probably get the fact that the medical world is not really a bastion of free market capitalism, is it really? I mean, you're going after something which is completely controlled, and there are privileges and licensing and all sorts of rules and regulations. It's not exactly a wild free for all. You almost have to work within government privilege, and you're always lobbying for some kind of a government grant of privilege. Would that be a fair assessment, really, Doctor?
Well, yes. I mean, doctors are not having the same, most doctors are not having the same ability to earn money as they once did.
No.
Because of how insurance companies control so much, you know, and it is true that that really medicine has declined a lot in so many ways. I mean, you have to really try to stay healthy from all your life. And to avoid having to go to a hospital. I mean, for example, UCLA these days, they are teaching their students, medical students, to be so anti-Semitic. You don't want to be Jewish and go to UCLA.
No, I would not recommend it. It's not a really comfortable atmosphere at the moment. I'll concede your point.
But in addition to that, regardless of what religion you are, you know, doctors are cutting corners right and left. Because of the hold, the clamp that the insurance company has on us, you know, especially if you have a practice where you depend upon insurance, which most doctors do, because there is so much paperwork, and for psychiatrists, I think one of the worst places where insurance has affected medicine is in psychiatry. Because that is what has turned most psychiatrists into pill pushers. You know, when I was being trained, yes.
Oh, okay. I'd love to hear about this. How has the insurance industry turned psychiatry into pill pushing rather than trying to actually, I guess, organically, if you want to term it that, help someone with their problem. Go ahead.
Well, because, you know, the way I was trained at NYU Bellevue, which was an incredible program. I have not seen one as good as that since. We were trained to combine that therapy comes first. You know, that the most important part of treatment is giving therapy to a person, psychotherapy. And medication, if the person needs, there are certain kinds of disorders where a person needs medication or can be helped by medication, but medication isn't a cure. And it's certainly not going to be a cure if you don't do therapy with it. But what has happened, and it started, you know, let's see, I mean, it started at least, well, it's been getting worse over the years, but where the insurance company realized that it's cheaper to pay a social worker or even a psychologist to do therapy with patients and just pay psychiatrists to give out prescriptions, give patients medications.
Okay.
And so psychiatrists have, if they're not going to ask about, you know, their child, the person's childhood and their, and get to the bottom of why they're depressed, for example, they can just have the person come in for like anywhere from 15 minutes to 45 minutes and get a basic history, not a good history, and figure out what pill you're going to give them. Then, and give them an appointment for a month from then. And then if the person comes back and they're not better, which of course they never are, because you, you know, whatever pill it is, even if you picked one that was really good for what their problems were, since you didn't do therapy, they're not going to be better. So then what do the doctors, what does the psychiatrist do? They give another prescription. They give more pills. They keep giving pills and pills and pills. Like some people are on five different kinds of medication because the medication didn't work. And it's not going to work if you're not in therapy. And so this is why we have a lot of crazy people walking around. That's one of the reasons.
But as you're telling me, Dr. Lieberman, it appears then that therapy is considered too expensive in the medical and insurance industry complex. It's too expensive?
Exactly.
Wow.
Because if you give a person 45 minutes to an hour of therapy, that costs more than 20 minutes of giving them, you know, medication. So this is what the majority of psychiatrists are doing these days, even though it doesn't work. I refuse to do that. I won't treat a patient unless they come to me for therapy at least once a week. Then also if they need meds, yes, I will, you know, very cautiously give them medication. But, you know, if without the therapy, nothing's going to work. But it's cheaper. It's cheaper than, you know, because if you're going to be spending 20 minutes of the psychiatrist's time rather than an hour of the psychiatrist's time, of course it's going to be cheaper.
Wow. Okay. So it's cheaper, but it doesn't work as well. So what's
exactly.
Okay. Man, you know, that kind of reminds me what happened. Well, a relative of mine a number of years ago was having depression. He was an elderly man who was depressed and was in with his regular general practitioner just for a checkup. And at that time, the doctor just said, are you feeling a little blue? And just offered to provide happy pills. He actually termed them happy pills. And I think it was Prozac that the doctor ended up giving this man. And then he ended up, the relative ended up going south and started talking about wanting to do horrible things to the home pets. I mean, I'm serious. And then he said, I think these pills are making me funny. They make me feel funny. And so they backed away from that kind of stuff. But that may happen even today.
Yes.
More than we think.
Of course. This happens all the time. And even where patients commit suicide because if you're depressed. And that's one of the examples. Particularly with depression, that's dangerous because, I mean, well, it's all dangerous. Schizophrenia, if they're not cured, or not cured, but if they're not in treatment, I mean, if they're not getting better, that there are lots of bad things that can happen too. But with depression, the typical thing is it takes 3 weeks for the antidepressant to work at the full level that it's going to work. Mm-hmm. And some all medicines aren't alike. You have to work very carefully to figure out what is going to work best for a particular patient. But the thing is, if you give someone an antidepressant, the danger is that you will make them too quickly become happy, and to the point where they then think of committing suicide. In other words, it's not really happy in a healthy kind of sense. It's like you can push them over if they're bipolar, manic depressive. You can actually push them over into mania. There's so many things. I mean, there are a lot of different things that can happen if you are not cautious. And so the thing is, you're supposed to really see them once a week. Even if you were going to just give them medication, you can't just give somebody a prescription and send them off on their way, because there are a lot, they can have all kinds of side effects. They can, including becoming suicidal.
So part of making America mentally healthier would require actually having psychiatrists really seeing patients, truly seeing patients, and really, really performing therapy. Then is what you're advocating,
yes,
right?
Yes, which is how it used to be. You know, it never used to be like this. This is not how I was trained, and then of course, what you bring up a good point. There are a lot of people who are getting going to their GP for their family doctors for because they're feeling, you know, having mental problems of one sort or another. And the GPs are coming into areas that they don't belong. You know, if it was enough to have just a basic medical training, be a GP, and that was enough to know how to take care of someone's psychiatric problems, then you wouldn't need psychiatrists. Psychiatrists do 3 or 4 years extra
on this. And when it comes right down to it, someone is depressed not necessarily because they have a shortage of fluoxetine in their brain, right?
Yes, right.
Okay.
So, you know, really, family doctors do not know what they're doing when it comes to treating mental problems. And they certainly don't have the time to do therapy with patients. They don't even have – that's another problem. Family doctors don't even have enough time to look into what is behind whatever it is that the person has, or to do enough tests. And of course, that's if, you know, they're so worried these days, they're going to do too many tests and the insurance company is going to be mad at them. I mean, yes, it is true. You know, no wonder people are cheering on Luigi for having killed this insurance CEO.
Yeah. And like I said, I'm not advocating it or cheering it on, but I think I understand where it comes from. I think we all do. I think we understand where that comes from a bit. But I did not realize in the psychiatric world how tilted towards the pharmaceutical drugs and away from therapy that it is, because I've just not had the need, you know, to go through this, at least so far. I don't know. After the last few years, I might have to come see you. But, you know, in all seriousness, would you what do you think about direct primary or direct care? Do you get to the point where you might have to be going more, if you're going to treat a patient really well in psychiatry, to have to just have someone pay you rather than going through insurance? Is that even a possibility? Does that happen these days?
This is what I do, because I learned this early on when I started out. You know, I took all kinds of insurance. And it didn't take long to figure out that insurance companies make you take up so much time. I mean, even if you had a billing person, there is so much work because they don't want to pay you what they're supposed to pay you. Like, you know, it says a certain amount, a certain procedure, mm-hmm. or a certain
right.
amount of time, or it's supposed to be X, you know, and they don't want to pay you X. So you have to spend all this time fighting with them. So I soon learned that I didn't want to spend all my time fighting insurance companies. I wanted to treat patients. So I stopped. People need to pay me, you know, when I see them.
Okay.
And because otherwise, this is not how I want to spend my life, fighting with insurance companies.
This is a growing trend. I've been speaking with many physicians on the side. They're saying they're in the same place that you are. Just can't do this. Can't work the insurance racket anymore. And yet the insurance rackets control most of the healthcare dollars at this point in time. It's very insightful. Thanks for joining me, Dr. Lieberman, and letting me know. I didn't realize it was affecting the psychiatric world here, too, in your profession here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And before we wrap up, thanks for the talk. And where can people find out more about everything, Dr. Lieberman, again?
Well, one of my favorite webs. Well, actually, there's Expert Witness Forensic Psychiatrist. People, you know, I do a lot of malpractice cases too, where, you know, for some of the things we've just been talking about. And then, of course, terroristtherapist.com.
Very good. Doctor, thanks so much for having joined the show. Good talk. Always appreciate it.
You're very welcome.